You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass Politics. I'm Ben Mathis. Hey, folks, we're doing a new crowdfunding campaign at patreon.com/kickasspolitics. That's Patreon spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N. With Patreon, you can pledge a certain amount each month, and in return for helping to sustain the show, you're going to get some great new benefits like back episodes, exclusive content, show merchandise, shout-outs on the podcast, video hangouts, invitations to live events, and more. Again, go to patreon.com/kickasspolitics. Thanks for your support, and thanks for continuing to listen. And now, enjoy the podcast. After 162 years, that sad day has come. The moment the GOP finally jumped the shark. The chairman of the Republican National Committee, Reince Priebus, has said it's time for conservatives to rally around the nominee, at least when they're not busy rallying around a pyre of burning books. But if you've been watching the convention, you've probably seen a lot of empty seats in the Quicken Loans arena. Turns out there are a number of prominent Republicans who would rather be caught in a transsexual stripper bar than anywhere near Cleveland this week. Sure, House Speaker Paul Ryan and Senate Leader Mitch McConnell are there, but then they kind of had to show up, and their support for the very man who will likely cost them their majorities in Congress has been tepid at best. As you might recall from my recent interview with Senator McConnell, his endorsement of Trump pretty much went something like this. Well, he won fair and square, and I guess I said I'd support the nominee, so here I am. In McConnell's speech to the convention last night, his enthusiasm for the nominee was surpassed only by the delegates' enthusiasm for his speech, which is to say, there wasn't much enthusiasm. Paul Ryan, who 4 years ago stood on the stage as the vice presidential nominee, mentioned Trump only one time during his 12-minute speech, and then proceeded to repudiate everything Donald Trump stands for, and favored the audience with his best impression of a salmon as he pleaded with Republicans to be the party of inclusiveness, optimism, and opportunity for all. And then there was this.
If you love our country and love your children as much as I know that you do, stand and speak and vote your conscience. Vote for candidates up and down the ticket who you trust to defend our freedom and to be faithful to the Constitution.
Yeah, he did it. As Senator Ted Cruz pulled off the most controversial mic drop in political convention history, all I could think was, holy shit. Now, I've never actually watched HBO's Game of Thrones. I'm not particularly big on fantasy. But I imagine the Red Wedding went something like that. The greatest irony of all is that at a convention bereft of passion and enthusiasm, Ted Cruz, of all the people, seemed downright giddy to be there. But it's telling that the list of Republican leaders who aren't at the RNC this year is a lot longer than the list of those who are. 4 of the last 5 men the party nominated for president have politely abstained from attending, including former Presidents George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush, Senator John McCain, and Mitt Romney, who outright said he will not support Trump as the nominee. The only one who is there is Bob Dole, but he was also overheard shouting "I like Ike" during Melania's speech, so let's face it, he might not know where he is anyway. Dick Cheney is skipping the convention, as is Condoleezza Rice. 18 Republican senators are conspicuously absent, including Rand Paul and Jeff Flake, who actually told reporters he plans to mow his lawn this week. Sarah Palin decided to stay in Alaska. GOP mega donor Sheldon Adelson is elsewhere, mocking Trump's paltry $10 billion net worth, or $2 billion, or whatever it is. Two of the party's rising stars, Governors Nikki Haley and Susana Martinez, decided to take a powder room break and skip it. But then they've both had less than chummy relationships with DJT, and we all know how well he does with women and minorities. Master of the subtle snub, Ohio's popular Republican Governor John Kasich decided the two-hour drive from Columbus would put him over the miles limit on his car lease, which in turn ruined the carpool plans of Ohio Senator Rob Portman, so he's sitting this one out as well. And word has it that the descendants of Republican President Grover Cleveland are launching a PR campaign to remind folks that the city where it's all going down was not named after their great-great-grandfather. All of this is to say nothing of the very long list of Republican no-shows who've taken the extra step of publicly denouncing Donald Trump and outright saying they will not vote for him. That's called twisting the knife, kids. I already mentioned Mitt Romney, he's on that list, and both Presidents Bush have said that they will likely write in a candidate or vote Libertarian in November. Jeb Bush has also said he won't vote for Trump, no surprise there. The same goes for Senators Ben Sasse, Susan Collins, and Mark Kirk, who grudgingly endorsed Trump a few months ago, but now says he won't support or vote for him. The Republican governors of Massachusetts, Illinois, and Maryland have publicly said they won't support Trump, along with GOP Congressman Justin Amash, Carlos Curbelo, Robert Dold, Richard Hanna, Reid Ribble, Scott Riggle, Ileana Ross-Leighton, and Mark Sanford. Just a few of the previous guests on this show who have now publicly said they absolutely will not vote for Donald Trump include Senator Lindsey Graham, conservative radio host Steve Deese, Michael Reagan, and Senator Mike Lee, who's been at the convention this week actively lobbying the RNC to unbind the delegates. My previous guest, Glenn Beck, said in no uncertain terms he will not vote for Trump, but you can hear it from his own mouth.
I'm not for Trump. Okay. I won't vote for him, and I don't recommend people do. I recommend people look at who he is.
And then there's Bill Kristol, editor of the Weekly Standard, who is actively trying to lure a third-party conservative to run against Donald Trump. He won't vote for the nominee, and he certainly didn't hold back when he came on the show.
When someone very vulgar becomes a central figure in politics, the whole political discussion becomes vulgar. And this is one of the most depressing things for me, the notion that the Republican Party of Reagan and of Bush and of McCain, even Romney, who I wasn't crazy about, but I think is a decent man and ran on a decent platform, the idea that that's going to become the party of Trump. I don't want to vote for Hillary Clinton, and I don't want to vote for Donald Trump.
And then there's my guest next week, Ben Shapiro, who's publicly said he won't vote for Trump either. Here's a little teaser of what he says on next week's podcast.
Are you going to support the nominee?
Right now, no.
Okay.
It's not my job as a conservative to support the nominee. My job as a conservative is to support
conservatism. Well, then you and I are on the same page. Well, I'll shake your hand right now.
Well, you're one of the few who will. I mean, I'm a conservative before I'm a Republican.
Yeah.
But this is what annoys me. Every cause for which I have fought my entire political career, he's pretending to carry the mantle of it and destroying it at the same time. What I don't get is the enthusiastic embrace for Trump's absolute incompetence, his bigotry, his nastiness, the fact that he doesn't know what the hell he's talking about, the fact he doesn't know what the Constitution is. Don't cover for that stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I understand you want to win, but to be forced into a position where you now have to support every stupid thing he says. One of two things is going to happen here. Either he's going to win, in which case he ain't going to listen to you, or he's going to lose, in which case you just sacrificed all of your principles to lose by 10 points to Hillary Clinton. Congratulations.
They aren't outliers in the Republican Party, and unlike Donald Trump, who was still registered as a Democrat just 6 years ago, they aren't Johnny-come-latelys to conservatism. As recently as just a few months ago, Republicans still looked up to these people as leaders in the party, men and women who worked for years and even decades to shape the conservative philosophy, to put strict constitutionalists on the bench, to take back the GOP majority in the House and Senate, and to grow the party. Conservative thinkers whose opinions you respected, candidates you supported, and maybe even campaigned for. But now, they are conservatives in exile, ridiculed and derided by the Donald and his thuggish army of malcontents, who've turned words like establishment and intellectual against them, much like a bunch of grade school bullies mocking the smart kid in class and calling him a brainiac or a nerd to distract from their own ignorance and inadequacies. This episode today is part therapy session, part wake for the death or at least infirmity of the once grand old party. Maybe on a personal level, it's also reassuring to know that I'm not alone in this. But mostly, it's important to show the rational thinking Americans out there and the people who know me best, including many Democrats, libertarians, and independents, that there are Republicans who still put country before party, who won't just stay quiet and fall in line with a GOP that's turned on its own and abandoned its principles. There are Republicans, millions of them in fact, who will say to the very end, Donald Trump does not speak for us. Among those you'll hear from today are the leading Republican strategist behind the last Republican presidential campaign. He says the Trump effect could alienate voters from the party for generations to come. You'll hear from a former GOP governor who's working to get a third party on the ballot this year, but if forced to choose, will vote for Hillary over Trump. I'll speak to a leading conservative journalist who says the media's complicity in the Trump ascendancy will not soon be forgotten. And I'll also talk with two people who've done more than most to try and prevent this catastrophe. One is a former communications director for Jeb Bush, who was behind the leading anti-Trump super PAC. And then there's the delegate who spearheaded the effort to take the fight all the way to the convention floor this week. And believe me, when these conservatives say never Trump, they mean never. Coming up in just a moment.
From Hollywood to Washington, it's time for Kick-Ass Politics. And now here's your host, Ben Mathis.
Among the Republican holdouts against Trump, the first person I wanted to talk to is the man who was the brains behind the last Republican presidential campaign 4 years ago. Stuart Stevens is a GOP political strategist and media consultant who over the past 25 years has helped elect prominent Republicans, including Senator Rob Portman, Senator Roy Blunt, Governor Haley Barbour, Governor Tom Ridge, and President George W. Bush. In 2012, Stuart was the lead strategist for Governor Mitt Romney's presidential campaign, and most recently, he's written a new novel called The Innocent Have Nothing to Fear. And the reviews are in on The Innocent Have Nothing to Fear. Donald Trump says, if Stuart Stevens' book is as bad as his horrible political advice to Mitt Romney, don't waste your money. Arrogant guy, but a zero.
I hadn't even seen that.
You haven't seen that tweet? That's what he has to say about your book. So,
so funny. I don't have time to read Donald Trump's, all of his crazy tweets, and I'm not running for president, and he has time to respond to everything. He's a professional grievance monger.
Yeah.
You know, he spends most of his time, it seems, watching television and hanging out on the computer looking for examples of people who have not praised him adequately.
Yeah, you know, someone once told me this saying, and I think it's perfectly fits Donald Trump. He's an open wound looking for a knife.
I've never heard that either. That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, you were Mitt Romney's lead strategist, and it's strange because I feel like 4 years later, now we're getting Mitt Romney's evil twin.
a wealthy businessman who's everything that Mitt isn't, because you have the millionaire who got his money honestly, didn't rip off a bunch of people. Then you have the guy who, you know, started Trump University and screwed a bunch of middle class, hardworking people. You have one guy who's a good family man, loyal to his wife. You have another guy who's had three marriages to models. I mean, it's just, you know, one guy who's extremely articulate and very well informed, knows policy. And then you have another millionaire who's the exact opposite.
I laugh every time I hear Donald Trump described as, you know, anti-establishment. He's the essence of the American establishment. Inherited wealth living on Fifth Avenue.
Yeah.
I mean, the Trump company was started 93 years ago. A lot of people say, oh, Mitt Romney was, not a great candidate and everything. Well, on election day, Mitt Romney's favorables were 50%, his unfavorables 47 for plus three, about the same as President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
Despite this massive campaign that incumbent president is able to muster. Today, Donald Trump has minus 25 to 30 negatives. By any measure, Trump is a much, much worse candidate.
I have to wonder, it must drive you crazy that Romney got completely crucified for his 47% comment, and yet Trump can say anything. In his own words, he can literally shoot someone on Fifth Avenue, and his people will still support him.
There's two ways to look at that. Trump does say this crazy, disqualifying stuff, but in a way he doesn't get away with it because only about 33% of the country likes Donald Trump.
Yeah.
You know, Trump is like a restaurant that has some loyal customers. People go there. Maybe you got engaged there. You like it. You know, the food's not great, but you like it. But he gets terrible. That restaurant gets terrible online reviews. And nobody knew was going to that. And Trump is not growing. And he spent today, for instance, the day he clumsily announced his vice president, attacking other Republicans. He reminds me of the suicide bomber instructor who stands in front of his class and says, pay attention. I'm only going to do this once. It's just so self-defeating.
Yeah. And you wrote a great article in the Daily Beast a couple of months ago called "The Republican Myth of the Untapped White Voter." I thought we learned that lesson in the postmortem from 2012 election. How badly do we need to get beaten for this to sink in?
Yeah, it's a really good point. And I give Reince Priebus a lot of credit for going through that so-called autopsy. It's a very hard thing for any organization to be self-critical, particularly an organization that you just led.
Yeah.
And I thought Reince really did that well. Most of those conclusions were right. I would quibble with some. But the unfortunate thing is the party is going in the complete opposite direction, with every reason to believe it will have disastrous consequences. You can't really argue that there's not a political imperative for a party to represent a larger part of America than the Republican Party in national elections has been able to. You just can't get elected a national election without expanding the Republican Party. You know, before 1964, Republicans got routinely around 30-35% of African Americans, which isn't great, but isn't catastrophic. I mean, if you're at 35%, you can foresee getting to 40, and if you're at 40, you can foresee getting to 50. But after the 64 election, it just fell off the cliff. So now in these recent polls, in swing states like Ohio, Pennsylvania, Donald Trump was getting 0% of African American votes. You couldn't even find an African-American for Donald Trump. You know, when I worked on the Bush campaign in 2004, we got up to, I think, 40% of Hispanic vote.
Right.
That then, for a number of reasons, dropped off. You know, in July of 2011, a generic Republican was getting 27% of Hispanics, and Mitt ended up with 27% of Hispanics. That doesn't mean that the primary hurt him. It just didn't help him. But now Trump is doing worse. He has a favorable like 65% with just Hispanic Republicans. They're the ones that are supposed to like us. And if you look at the last few cycles, whatever Republican vote that Hispanics gave in California pretty much mirrored the national numbers. Right now, Donald Trump is getting 12% in California.
Huh.
So if what happened in 1964 with African Americans happens with Hispanics in 2016, it's generationally destructive to any chance Republican Party has to win a national election.
Well, in March, Governor Romney, who you worked for in 2012, gave what I thought was a positively Churchillian speech, articulately laying out the case against Donald Trump. What was the goal there? Was he sincerely thinking he might be able to sway the unswayable Trump voters? Or what was the goal?
I think Mitt is nothing if not realistic. I mean, he is a very good analyst of data, and he it's one of the reasons he was so successful in business. He's able to look at a situation and not kid himself about the reality of it. I think he spoke up because exactly what he said. He thought it was a matter of conscience. And he wanted to go on record how he felt. And, you know, pretty much I think with Mitt now, his on the record is the same as his off the record. I mean, he's saying what he straight out believes from the heart.
Unlike Trump.
Well, Trump, you know, who knows what's in his heart, but I don't really care. It's what he says.
Yeah. Are you sure you can't talk Mitt into a third party run?
You know, I think he's realistic about the odds of winning in a third party. You know, it's very, very difficult. And you could make a case that you could throw it into the House of Representatives, because if no one gets 270 electoral votes, it goes to the House. But it's very difficult to make a case that the independent would be in first place if it was thrown into the House. And the odds seem overwhelmingly that the independent would be in third place. Just, I don't think Mitt, you know, I mean, I think he looks at this and to run with no chance of winning, and yet any candidate has to position themselves as if they could win.
Yeah.
That there was something about that that just didn't ring true with him.
Yeah. On this show, we all have our reasons for not supporting Donald Trump this year. But what is it that personally bothers you most about him?
I believe that one of the essential elements of being a successful president is having a humbleness that allows you to learn and to admit mistakes. Because the one thing we know about all presidents is they make mistakes, larger or smaller, but they all make mistakes. And your ability to learn from that, I think, is essential. Trump seems incapable of learning from mistakes. Because he won't admit that he was wrong. That ultimately, I think, is the most unfixable part of Donald Trump is, you know, he's just a badly damaged person. I have no idea what happened to him, but something unfortunate. He really doesn't have any friends. He has this weird little world of people that he pays to praise him. And that's a very dangerous trend. I mean, he was supposed to announced his vice president today at 11 o'clock news conference. And last night at midnight, apparently he was saying, well, do I have to really pick Pence? It's just, this is not someone that you'd want to sit next to flying across the country, much less hand the nuclear codes to.
So this is probably not someone who's going to appoint a cabinet of rivals.
No, it you know, with Donald Trump, there are two approaches. Either defiance or submission. And he humiliates anyone who supports him. And because once you've submitted to Donald Trump, he doesn't respect you.
Yeah.
And unwillingness to see that, or we tend to look at a lot of people, it's very human instinct, look at Donald Trump and say, okay, I am going to give this person the benefit of the doubt of being a normal person. He's not.
Yeah. Well, Stuart, you know as well as anyone that there's a difference between campaigning and governing. Presidents always talk about that moment at some point after they're sworn in when it dawns on them the weight of the office, the obligation to live up to the integrity of the presidency and the legacy of those who came before. Do you think if Donald Trump was elected, he could grow into the role of president?
He has no respect for governing, nor does he understand it. I mean, he's someone who's talking about defending Article 12 of the Constitution. There is no Article 12.
I haven't heard that one.
Yeah, no. In a meeting with when he met with House Republicans, They were asking him about his understanding of Article 6, which he had, and Article 2, both of which he had no inkling of. And he kind of said, well, I'll defend all the articles, you know, 1, 12, whatever you want.
Well, you know, the way he talks, he just might create an Article 12 on his own.
Say what you will about Hillary Clinton. If you impeached her, she'd leave office.
Yeah.
And I don't think Donald Trump would. I think he'd attempt not to. He just has no understanding of sort of basic fundamental American values.
Stuart Stevens and other guests on this episode laid much of the blame for this catastrophe squarely at the feet of those in the conservative media who sold their souls for ratings and caved in to Donald Trump. So I talked to one widely respected journalist and leading conservative in the media who didn't just roll over, and as a result, he too has been on the receiving end of more than his share of angry and sometimes bizarre tweets by Donald Trump. Jonah Goldberg is a senior editor at National Review, a syndicated columnist, author, and Fox News all-star. He's also been called a stupid guy, truly dumb as a rock, a dummy, who does a pathetic job and apparently is the reason why National Review is going out of business. You can probably guess who it was that said that about him. Jonah, welcome on the show.
It's great to be here, Ben. Thanks.
So those are just a few of the things that Donald Trump, the tweeter-in-chief, has said about you on Twitter. I think one of my favorite responses, you said, Donald Trump thinks I'm a pain in the ass. Alas, he doesn't realize that's the fastest route to his brain.
Well, so the other thing you left out, though, which I was sure you were going to go there, is I wrote some column about him, and some NBC reporter read it to him, and he did his usual routine of, I went to the best schools, I made all this money, I have all these businesses, and I got to hear this from a guy like that who can't even buy pants. I have spent, I have teams of interns working around the clock trying to figure out what the hell he was talking about, because while I wouldn't claim to be great at buying pants, you know, it's not like it's not what I lead with in job interviews, you know, but at the same time, it's not like my wife gets phone calls from like a Home Depot manager saying, I'm sorry, Mrs. Goldberg, we found your husband trying to buy pants in the power tool aisle again. But anyway, such as it is.
Yeah, he comes up with very creative insults. I wonder if maybe he was trying to say something along the lines of Jonah Goldberg, who doesn't wear long pants, belittle you as if, say that you're a little boy or something, and just kind of screwed it up along the way.
Well, that's possible. It was always possible to think he said something stupidly, but you know, that was one of the things we greaseboarded for a while, and then we ruled it out. So it's we've been studying this for a long time. It's kind of like a Manhattan Project here to figure out what he was talking about. But anyway.
Well, you said that Trump's popularity is corrupting conservatism itself. What do you fear is the lasting damage he's doing to the GOP?
I'm perfectly willing to say that there might be some silver lining, but let's talk about the dark cloud for 2 seconds first. Mm-hmm. You know, my entire life in conservatism, and in one form or another, I grew up in it. The conservatism I've always associated myself with at the most metaphysical level is basically only about two things. And it's the two things are, one, that ideas matter. As Richard Weaver said in his book, ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. And that we should be engaged in making reasonable, rational arguments about how we have the better way to go. And Donald Trump stands athwart that, I would argue, almost entirely. He has emotions, he has instincts, he has passions, and all of that, but he is utterly and completely, and I would argue, unpatriotically uninterested in serious ideas, save as sort of marketing tools that are spoon-fed to him. And the second thing that the conservatives believe in is character.
He's a character, all right. I'll give him that.
Character matters. You know, and there's a debate
Personal character, of course.
Yeah, no, but just as there's a debate about which ideas matter, we can have a debate about what we mean by character, but we can talk about business character. He rips off people. You can talk about personal sexual character. You can talk about religious character. I'm open to different debates about what we should mean about character in our public life. It's a perfectly valid thing to argue about. But I've yet to come up with a definition of character that he doesn't fall short of.
Is it a case where the traditional conservative message of small government, putting power in the people's hands instead of Washington's hands, has gotten hijacked or perverted so that now it's just a rant against anyone who has any experience, any expertise, anyone who knows policy is a pariah, and it's just this blanket embrace of amateurism?
I think there's a lot to that. I mean, there's certainly a lot to that, and I think that explains some of it. I also think that part of the problem is that everybody overpromised and underdelivered. And, you know, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh like to talk about how, you know, Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell and those guys overpromised and underdelivered, and they're right. But so did Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh and Ted Cruz and those guys. They promised things that Ted Cruz couldn't deliver, saying the government shut down, that that no one could deliver. And then in comes this guy who just basically says, they're all idiots, they're all weaklings, they're all pussies. I'm going to come in and I am just going to be a 800-pound alpha ape and get everything done. And I find it just shockingly BS. I mean, I just think he's a con man. Yeah. I do not understand how people can take his promises seriously or think, you know, this is a guy whose daily clippings, the things he reads to get up to speed, all his staff does is type into Google News Donald Trump and then print out the findings. And he reads through all of it. He doesn't read about what's going on in Syria. He doesn't read about what's going on in Russia. The only thing he cares about in his narcissism is what people are saying about him. And he marks up the pages. The guy is unbelievably ill-prepared to be president of the United States. And the fact that people can't see it baffles me. The fact that people don't care doesn't, because they think, look at these jackasses with all the right credentials. Look how little they've done. How could this guy do worse? And I get that argument. I just think it's wrong.
My favorite is everyone likes to say what a great communicator and a great marketing genius he is. But, you know, I listened to 5 minutes of the words out of his mouth, and I don't think that. Rather than admitting that he's so extraordinary at what he does, do some of us in the Conservative Party maybe have to do some soul searching, admit that there's a lot of ignorance perhaps within our party, or at least a significant ignorant demographic that's driven this?
Yes and no. I mean, history is full of examples of smart people losing their minds or refusing to see what is obvious. I mean, the number of college-educated people who swooned for the secular messiah of Barack Obama in 2008,
true.
You know, it wasn't that they're stupid people. It's just that they got ensorcelled. And that's the definition of a charismatic personality, is somebody who you can project all your goals and aspirations on, even though they offer you almost no credible explanation about how they're going to fulfill them. And, you know, it's overdone, but this idea that Trump is sort of a Republican Barack Obama has more merit to it than people want to recognize. I mean, I've been writing about the perils and dangers of populism for a very long time. The only populist movement I ever liked was the Tea Party movement, because I thought they were going to fulfill that ancient libertarian prophecy of taking over the government and then leaving everybody alone. But the problem with populism, historically speaking, populism is anti-ideological, it's anti-intellectual, it's anti-idea. It basically means that the mob is right. You know, as William Jennings Bryan, the most famous populist in American history, said, the people of Nebraska are for free silver, therefore I am for free silver. I will look up the arguments later. And that's the situation that we're facing inside the ranks of the Republican Party and the grassroots. And I understand it. I really understand why people are fed up with the status quo. I understand why they're sympathetic to some of the stuff that Donald Trump is doing. I call it the Trump non sequitur. I agree with almost all of the arguments for Donald Trump. We need to overturn the status quo. We need to sort of move past these sort of stale policy debates. We need to take sovereignty more seriously. We need to take into account the lives of the rank and file, lower middle class who are hurting. I agree with all of that stuff. You just lose me entirely when you then say, and that's why we have to support Donald Trump.
As a journalist, what do you have to say about the other media outlets like the Breitbart.coms and the Drudge Reports, who cut off all oxygen to every other candidate whose initials weren't DJT?
One thing that Donald Trump has revealed is the enormous number of hacks out there. mm-hmm. who turns out weren't the conservative purists that we thought they were or that they said they were, but are instead, you know, they like Trump's celebrity, they like his ratings, they like going to Mar-a-Lago, who knows? But they certainly didn't like the pure conservatism that they claimed to like a while back. One can get into a whole sort of very cynical thing about, you know, cui bono, you know, who's paying them and all that kind of stuff. I have no idea any of that kind of stuff. It might just be pure innuendo. But I don't follow Drudge that closely, but I suspect that his support for Donald Trump is partly because he agrees with Donald Trump, partly because he's a huge pot stirrer, and partly because he's very, very close with Ann Coulter, who's essentially, you know, the Beria of the Trump world. So that, I can understand the Drudge stuff. In terms of Breitbart, you know, I have friends over there. Andrew Breitbart was a very close friend of mine, and I just find it all heartbreaking. And I think that Joel Pollack, you know, who I've always been cordial and friendly with, except for a few Twitter spats in the last few months, you know, who says that it is outrageous and inappropriate for anybody to speculate about what Andrew Breitbart would have believed or not believed, is the biggest, wimpiest dodge. Because he clearly knows that Breitbart wouldn't support this stuff, yeah. that Andrew wouldn't support this stuff. And it takes an enormous amount of chutzpah for a guy to claim that it is absolutely outrageous to speculate on what Andrew Breitbart would have believed, and yet continues to name the publication Breitbart. If it has no connection with the man and no connection with his personality and what he believed in, change the friggin' name to Pollack.com or Bannon.com and be done with it. But they want to ghoulishly live off of Andrew's memory while at the same time sort of shunning and shaming anybody who says rightly and factually accurately that some of the stuff they are doing would embarrass Andrew terribly.
Are you more worried that the GOP nominee will lose to Hillary, or are you more worried that he might win?
I go back and forth about this every 20 minutes. It's a choice between two crap sandwiches, and the condiments are different. The bread is different. And, you know, look, National Review didn't endorse Kennedy or Nixon in 1960 mm-hmm. because neither met the minimal threshold requirements for conservatives. Neither is sufficiently conservative that I'm going to let them speak for me, or that I'm not going to tell the truth about them as I see it. And I'm very much in the Hamiltonian tradition on this, that if you're going to have an enemy in government, better he not run your own party, but the other party, because at least then you have no ownership of what they're going to do. I'm a free trader. I'm a limited government guy. The things that Donald Trump says a lot about a lot of stuff disgust me and offend me. And at the very least, everyone knows that Hillary Clinton's not doing it in my name. I wouldn't want Donald Trump doing it in my name either. And so it's I go back and forth about it, you know. And if I lived in if the election came down to my vote, I would be very torn and agonize about it and all the rest. But what's a lot easier decision for me to make is that I'm just going to tell the truth. And they both suck.
Now that Trump's taken the Republican nomination, where do never Trump conservatives go from here?
When the country goes into a choice between nationalism and socialism, or national socialism, that leaves me homeless. And so I believe, you know, that we got to start over in a lot of ways. We got to make arguments that we weren't making before. We got to make them better. I want to be able to say that character matters and ideas matter. And I don't want to run into somebody in 2017 or 2025 who says, well, you say that now, but you supported Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think that if I'm going to have credibility, and if people are going to have credibility trying to make the case for things like free trade and limited government and constitutionalism and all that kind of stuff in a thoughtful and serious way, you have to account for the things you said and did at this time of choosing. And I think we're seeing a lot of people making bad choices that are going to hurt them in the long run. And if they don't hurt them in the long run, that means the party is lost to me anyway. And people who are traditional small government, limited government, libertarian-leaning conservatives, then we're going to be like the actual Libertarian Party and just be outside the two-party system for a while until people come to their senses.
Yeah.
Or until we're all living in, you know, bunkers and, you know, drinking puddle water.
We're going to take a quick break right now, and then when I come back, I'll talk with a prominent former Republican governor who says she might just do the unthinkable and vote for Hillary this year. I'll also talk with a former communications director for Jeb Bush, who was behind the leading anti-Trump PAC in the primary, and a conservative delegate who's behind the movement to allow GOP delegates to vote their conscience at this week's convention. When we come back in just a moment. If you enjoyed my earlier conversation with Republican strategist Stuart Stevens, then you'll enjoy his new novel, The Innocent Have Nothing to Fear. It doesn't get more insider than that, folks. And now, you can download the audio version of his book for free with a special promotion just for our listeners from Audible.com. Just go to audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics for a free 30-day trial and a free audiobook download, which can be The Innocent Have Nothing to Fear by one of my guests today, Stuart Stevens, or any of Audible's 180,000 titles. That's audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. Or click on the sponsor link on our webpage to download the free audiobook of your choice. And now, back to the show. We're back, and today I'm talking with a number of prominent Republicans who say Donald Trump will never get their support. One demographic Donald Trump is having trouble with is women. In 2012, Mitt Romney received 44% of the vote. That's a point more than McCain got in 2008 and 4 points down from Bush in 2004. But a recent CNN poll revealed that a staggering 73% of female voters have a negative view of Donald Trump. And even 47% of Republican female voters said they could not imagine themselves voting for him in the general election. One of them is this woman. I'm talking with former New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman, who has been an outspoken critic of Donald Trump. As a former Republican governor, I would assume that you are at least offered the chance to be a delegate to the convention. Are you attending the Republican National Convention?
Well, actually, I ran as a delegate at large for John Kasich. And since we didn't win, and it's not a proportional state, New Jersey, no, I am not.
Okay. Are you probably happy not to be there?
Very.
Yeah.
Actually, there's no role.
Does he offend you more as a woman or as a Republican?
As a possible president.
Yeah.
but what upsets me is the language he's used, the emotions to which he's appealed. Hatred and fear are just not a good way to bring the country together, and we desperately need to be brought together. His business acumen is certainly open to question with 4 bankruptcies, and I don't agree with him on climate change or any of the environmental issues. I certainly don't agree with him banning all Muslims, and I think he puts us in a very dangerous position from an international and safety standpoint by saying that we should torture beyond waterboarding and that we ought to bomb the families, kill the families of terrorists. I mean, that just drives more people into those camps and allows the ISIL recruiters to be backed up when they say America hates you, America is going to try to do everything they can to destroy you, so join us and we can destroy them. Other than that, he'd be great.
A few minor adjustments. Trump likes to say that he can even win in blue states like his home state of New York and your state of New Jersey. What do you think his odds are of taking New Jersey in the general?
I think they're very slim.
Yeah.
I mean, we're a pretty moderate state. And of course, his history in this state hasn't been great. He'll claim he created thousands of jobs, which for a nanosecond he did, but we lost all of those and then some, and he left a lot of people hanging in Atlantic City.
And you were fairly critical of the current governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, for his rather craven and assumingly self-motivated endorsement of Donald Trump after he dropped out of the election. Do you think that his support will do anything to help Donald Trump in New Jersey?
Well, his approval rating, Chris Christie's approval rating in the state is in the 20s, so I don't think he's going to bring a lot to the table as far as getting New Jersey behind the presidential candidate.
Okay. It's almost a foregone conclusion that the Republican Party is going to be changed by this turn of events and at least in some part remade to suit the nominee. Do you still feel that you can identify with the party?
It's getting tougher and tougher, and frankly, I think both major parties are going to have to do a real reset after this election. They're both starting to move so far to the extremes that they're really leaving the majority of the American people with no place to go, and that's why you know, when you have two candidates for president, the two major party nominees with their negatives higher, way higher than their positives, there's something wrong. We can do better than that in this country. We deserve better if we take it into our own hands, as we being the people who can vote. And we need to start to get really engaged. But I think the winning party would be one that appeals to that central mass of people. It's why, you know, the unaffiliated have been, those are the registrations that have been growing, not Republican and Democrat.
One candidate who was hoping to win the nomination in the White House by actually reaching out and growing the party was former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Of course, we all know how that worked. But I talked with one of the top people on the Jeb campaign who stayed in the fight even after Governor Bush dropped out, working for a super PAC that spent millions against Donald Trump. He had some insight on how this whole GOP primary went so horribly wrong. I'm talking with Tim Miller. He was the communications director for the Jeb Bush campaign for president, and then he became a communications advisor for Our Principles PAC, which was the leading PAC spending money and attacking Trump in the GOP primary here. There was a thicker oppo file on this guy than there has ever been on any candidate that I can possibly think of, and yet none of it seems to matter. I was watching an interview with you where you were outlining a strategy to educate voters. Did voters just not want to be educated? What was the problem
there? Well, there are two parts of this. Yeah, number one, I'm an oppo guy, so this was unprecedented for me. You know, so there are two answers to your question. One is, with the primary electorate, Trump benefited from a fragmented field and from a base that was never going to leave him. All that said, though, you know, I think that he was skilled at creating this brand. It went all the way back to the Obama birther malarkey.
Right.
And, you know, he built up this kind of alligator skin where, you know, it didn't matter. You could tell his supporters the Fifth Avenue line, where I could shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue. That really tested out in the numbers. I mean, we would go very deep into the oppo book of all the terrible things about Trump to his supporters, and, you know, 1-2% would drop off. It was unprecedented any political polling data I've seen. His racist comments, you go through his bankruptcies, his personal issues. You go through the whole litany of all of the reasons that you wouldn't want Donald Trump to be president, and people who were his supporters were not moved off of him. Now, here are the things that did work, though, and this is why the general election is going to be such a disaster for him. College-educated women, when you go through all of the comments that he's made about women, that turned them off. And we were able to keep them from going to Trump in the primary. It just didn't matter because he had a greater support among all these other demographics. Hispanics, African-Americans, millennials, they all are extremely turned off by Trump's comments about a wide range of groups that we could go into. But the problem is there aren't enough African-Americans, Hispanics, and millennials voting in Republican primaries. So, you know, that while that oppo worked on those groups, it didn't hurt him in the primary because, you know, you're mostly dealing with a white male, older electorate in the Republican primary.
You were the communications director for the Jeb Bush campaign. And for the longest time,
yes, sir,
Jeb was the lone voice actually taking on Trump consistently throughout most of the GOP primary. And the other candidates,
somebody remembers that.
Yeah, and the other candidates, you know, they didn't join the fight until it was really too late. Does that make you mad that everyone was kind of a Johnny come lately to the fight that Jeb started?
Yeah, well, it makes me mad now when people say that, you know, Jeb didn't do enough or Jeb should have dropped out or it was Jeb's fault. When people try to blame Trump on Jeb, that upsets me because Jeb was months ahead. I remember being in a meeting where Jeb had been the only one attacking him for about a month, and I said, we need to start to take credit for this because these other guys are going to start doing this soon. That was in November. They didn't start until February. You know, look, I think that the only way to stop Trump, in my view, in retrospect, would have been collective action at the start,
yeah,
from Cruz, Carson, Marco, Jeb, Kasich, whoever I'm forgetting, and everybody going at him. In the same way that, you know, we would have had been the same way that everybody would have gone after Jeb had been Jeb in the lead. But everybody kind of presumed he was going to fall.
Yeah. And Our Principles PAC spent, I think, around 17 or 18 million against Donald Trump. Were you disappointed, yeah, that a lot of the big donors on the conservative side, the Sheldon Adelsons, the Koch brothers, sat on the sidelines and did nothing to stop this.
Yes, and elected officials. And look, I think that the Ricketts family, who started this before I even got on board, owner of the Cubs, go Cubs, I'm grateful that they stood out and did this because it was needed. I was shocked. You know, I think a big part of this was Cruz and a lot of the establishment and the donor class hated Cruz so much that they didn't, that they felt like it was, you know, choosing in the Iran-Iraq war. And so they stayed on the sidelines. But, you know, look, March, April, the time when there was kind of this last effort to stop Trump, a lot of our elected officials sat on the sidelines. A lot of the donors sat on the sidelines. And after we beat him in Wisconsin, you know, there was a big push, you know, to stop him. Then as you went along to the East Coast states, and there wasn't the interest. And I think a lot of people are going to look back on that and regret it.
Yeah, and then suddenly the panic set in once it was too late, after everyone had said, oh, he'll implode, let's not take him seriously. And then suddenly, once it's too late, and we're already in the middle of the primary voting, then suddenly everyone's freaking out. And then we go from almost instantly from it being too soon and Trump's going to implode to it being too late to do anything.
Yeah. Well, and frankly, some people, we shouldn't forget, got on board with him. And that stuff really hurt. You know, and Chris Christie, I hate to give him credit for anything, but when somebody that has, you know, credibility as a blue state governor, you know, was at one time a rising star, you know, comes out and endorses Trump, that stopped a lot of the bleeding for Trump, and that helped normalize him.
Have you talked to Jeb lately? How is he holding up nowadays?
Yeah, I talked to him the other day, and he's doing well. Look, I think that it was clear in this election that it was not going to be him. And there's, you know, I think while he wishes he was in this fight, and while I believe and he believes, I think rightly, that you know, if Hillary Clinton is tied with Donald Trump right now, that Jeb would have a pretty healthy lead on her. So that's a little bit frustrating. At the same time, I think he has solace in the fact that if the party was going to go for a Trump, it wasn't going to be Jeb, you know. And I think that sometimes you lose a campaign and you kind of lay up at night thinking, man, if only I'd done this thing different or that thing different, I would have won. I think he has solace in the fact that that wasn't the case for him. He made his best case and the party went completely the opposite direction. And, you know, so that's how politics works.
But one person who isn't quite ready to accept the Trump coronation is my next guest, who's taking the fight to stop Donald Trump all the way to this week's Republican National Convention. I'm talking with Kendall Unruh, who is a Colorado delegate to the Republican National Convention and co-founder of the Free the Delegates movement, which has been campaigning to get the Republican National Committee to unbind the delegates and allow them to, quote unquote, vote their conscience at the convention, or in other words, vote for someone other than Donald Trump. Kendall, thanks for calling in.
Oh, sure. Thanks for the time.
You had a bit of a setback last week when the RNC Rules Committee voted down your group's proposal to unbind the delegates. So what's next for you guys?
Well, they didn't just vote down the conscience clause. They stripped the party of everything that is remotely conservative. They made sure and guaranteed that the grassroots conservatives in the party never have a voice. And they put all the power back into the hands of the RNC and into the elite establishment. And Donald Trump, the establishment candidate that he has now revealed himself to be, was working in tandem with the RNC, whipping their votes, telling them exactly how to vote on every single rule.
Now, when you say the RNC was telling delegates how to vote, are you talking about the RNC chairman, Reince Priebus? What do you have to say about his role in all this?
Reince Priebus said, he was 10 feet from me when he said this on an interview, that they laid this issue to bed. No, what they did was they laid us on a bed of nails, and we are hopping mad about it because this is the grassroots element of our party are the ones who comprise the delegation on the floor. They chose to take this fight to the floor. Because I tried the decorum of the process by sponsoring the conscience clause. I never wanted to be criticized by not following the rules, by not following the process. So they chose this floor fight that's coming. because there will be backlash. There's not going to be a kumbaya moment because it's time to take back what was stolen from us.
So if you're planning to take this fight to the convention floor, what can we expect to see when all eyes are on Cleveland this week?
Well, when the cameras are on, you're going to see it in the hands of the people, because this entire movement has been about challenging this presumptive nominee without a candidate. And in essence, the grassroots are the candidate. It's the voice of the people. And so rather than work to earn the support of the delegates, you are having soft thug techniques that have been utilized all along in order to punish the delegates that were choosing to unbind.
Okay.
The other thing is they we're going to have to reject the rules package that they literally forced down the throats of the delegates. But let me tell you, the key is the delegates don't have to accept the rules package. Right now, we have no rules. We drafted them, but they are not accepted as the rules of the convention until they're adopted and voted on by all the delegates on the floor. And that's where we're at right now. The delegates will exercise their free conscience in whether or not to adopt those rules.
What do you say to the folks like Senator Lindsey Graham and others who were vehemently against Trump, or are still vehemently against Trump, but now say he won the primary fair and square and it would be undemocratic for the party to deny the will of the voters?
Well, number one, he really didn't win fair and square. He won a plurality, not a majority. That's the difference. He didn't win fair and square because he took advantage of open primaries and blanket primaries that brought in millions of independents and Democrats that actually chose our nominee for us. It is now our job and a duty as national delegates to either rubber stamp that or not. And let me be very clear. A primary is not a vote. A primary is a preference poll. It's our job. And we don't live in a democracy. It's a constitutional republic. And part of that constitutional republic we're seeing reflected in representative government, because that is what a delegate does. We're not robots. We don't go into our job and say we're going to just coronate a king, no matter who they put in front of us.
Have you polled your fellow delegates to get some kind of an idea of just how many GOP delegates at the convention would choose to nominate someone other than Donald Trump if they had that option?
Yes, we have. We've actually polled over half the delegates, and about 70% are in favor of what we're doing.
I'm on your side here, Kendall, but I'm sure you understand why Donald Trump wouldn't be in favor of unbinding his own delegates. I mean, you were never going to convince Donald Trump that this was going to be a good thing for him.
But there are people, delegates that are involved in our movement that actually just want the freedom of conscience to unbind. And they have said that they will still cast a ballot for Donald Trump. Donald Trump should have embraced this movement and said, hey, look, I can win. I can earn your support. But he is so entitled. He doesn't think that he needs to earn it. He thinks he has to get it through coercion and mandates and threatening the delegates and giving repercussions to the delegates.
Wait, what do you mean by threats?
We've had surrogates that we have proof that we're actually using threats of physical violence against our delegates. When I went public with this, I've had over 1,000 death threats. I'm actually in competition with some others. One other had over 3,000 when he went public against Donald Trump. And
literal death threats where they're saying, we're going to hurt you.
Yes, I had no idea there were so many creative ways to kill somebody. But these are the Trump supporters. Let me tell you what's so disconcerting to me about the fact that I have gotten tens of thousands of threats, but you know, specifically the death threats, is the fact that the heart of the candidate is reflected in the supporters. Just like you have a heart of a priest or a pastor that's reflected in the church or the parish, because you just tend to gravitate to somebody that you project yourself on because they reflect who you are. That is what we have in the Trump supporters, because you have a candidate that could have shut it down, and he chose not to. What he chose to do is he chose the demagogue, the hate, and the anger, and you had a candidate that incited that kind of incendiary behavior out of his followers. You all heard it. It was, I'm going to punch you in the face. If you punch him, I'll pay your legal bills. What presidential candidate says that kind of thing? But what has happened now is that has been transferred on from the supporters to the delegates that are voting, and they're being subjected to those threats. And of course, Donald Trump isn't shutting it down. He's encouraging it because that's how he's going to win this nomination. And it's absolutely appalling. I couldn't even imagine any of the presidential nominees in the past that would resort to these tactics, these soft thug tactics, in order to get a nomination.
So are you preparing for violence at the convention, perhaps?
Actually, I changed my hotel from the delegation hotel just for the safety measure of being within a very heavily guarded perimeter, because I feel like I need to.
Well, and you might have to go into witness protection before it's all over here. Sounds like.
Well, I'm confident that this is actually going to be something that helps overall the conservative movement remain a conservative movement with a voice.
On Monday, the first day of the convention, Kendall Unruh and her fellow delegates planned to carry the fight to the floor died when delegates were denied a voice vote on the RNC rules package. Unruh's Colorado delegation and the Idaho delegation walked out in protest, taking along with them all hope that the party of Abraham Lincoln might yet, in the 11th hour of the 2016 primary, find its bearings again. The following night, the delegates in Cleveland nominated their great orange messiah. I asked my guests, all lifelong Republicans, who they would vote for now that their party's nomination has been bestowed on a man who only 6 years ago was still a registered Democrat. Here's Kendall Unruh again. God forbid your efforts at the convention don't work and he ends up taking the nomination. Will you support him in November?
What kind of a hypocrite would that make me that I have all the reasons why? The fact that he's not a Republican, he's not reflective of our value system, his economic policies are protectionist, they're not free trade, he's not a social conservative. Why would I then suddenly jump on board and go, well, I was just kidding?
He does that all the time.
Yeah, well, and I agree with him on Tuesdays and Thursdays and on Saturdays after 10.
When asking Christine Todd Whitman who she might support in the general election, I reminded her of a statement she made during the primary, one that might surprise you. In March, you said that if Trump becomes the GOP nominee, you'll vote for Hillary Clinton. He's now the nominee of your party.
Well, I said I could vote for Hillary Clinton. I'm going to watch and see what actually transpires, and I'm supporting something called For a Better America, which is an effort to... Right now, we're on the ballot in 12 states. We need to be on the ballot in 14 states by the 1st of August in order to compete all the way through. But I am a firm believer that if we can do that and start getting some publicity about it and attract attention, that we will find that people will be very interested in that, and we'll get good candidates who will be willing to stand up for the good of the country and take on their parties.
What is this organization?
It's called For a Better America, and right now it's not a Stop Trump. It's a none of the above type of of an approach. It's nonpartisan, bipartisan, and the effort is to get on the ballot in enough states with 270 electoral votes actually to get on the ballot in all the states. I really believe we can do that, and with the frustration that I have sensed in the country and the people that I've talked to who are threatening not to vote, which to me is the absolute worst response, I believe sincerely that this candidate, provided it's a good, solid candidate, a credible candidate, can make a real difference and potentially win.
Now, do you have a candidate right now?
No. There are numbers, I said, who are credible people who have evidence and interest, but until we can prove to them that we are on the ballots and are competitive, it's pretty tough to ask them to do anything much more.
Okay. You can't tease any names for us, can you?
No, sorry. You can't tease any names out of me.
Okay. If, unfortunately, that doesn't work out, do you think that you'll be giving Hillary Clinton a close look?
Absolutely. I'll give her a close look. I'm troubled by, you know, the latest reports and the FBI report. And that's bad.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly going to vote.
Yeah. I don't think sitting at home and not voting in an election this important is an option.
Well, it really isn't in any, because what it does is it tells the incumbents that you don't care or what they're doing is fine. And if you don't like what they're doing, if you do care, then that's the wrong message to send. So you should get out there and vote and write in a name if that's what you have to do, but show where you are on the issues.
I also reminded Stuart Stevens about a similar statement he made about Hillary Clinton, and he took a more philosophical approach. Well, since you brought her up, during the GOP primary, I think it was in March, you said that Hillary Clinton would make a better president than Trump. He is now the GOP nominee, and you are a Republican. Does that mean that Hillary can count on your vote?
You know, I said that because I think Trump is uniquely unqualified to be president. You know, I would have said the same about Bernie Sanders. I would have said the same about you.
Hey, wait a minute. How did I get into this?
You're certainly more qualified than Donald Trump. And voting is a very personal affirmation.
Yeah.
It's not Sophie's choice. We don't have to make a choice. I don't feel necessary urgency to go out and, you know, defend Hillary Clinton. Or, I mean, I don't think that Hillary Clinton is likely to be a transformational president, either positive or negative. But, you know, PJ O'Rourke, the writer who I just love, wrote a great piece for the Daily Beast a few weeks ago. He said, well, you know, Hillary Clinton is awful, but she's awful within the normal parameters. Donald Trump is a flying monkey.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that's a good summation.
In the end, Stuart Stevens said he'll probably end up voting for the Libertarian candidate Gary Johnson in the general election. Among the Republicans I talked to, Johnson was a name that kept coming up with varying degrees of enthusiasm. National Review's Jonah Goldberg had this to say. I'm assuming that you are not then going to vote for the nominee.
I'm not going to vote for either major party nominee. But my vote doesn't matter. I live in Washington, D.C., so...
Well, see, now that's what all you guys keep saying. You guys keep copping out and saying your vote doesn't matter in D.C.
Well, look, I mean, it is not exactly a cop-out given that, you know, what does matter is what I write and say.
Right.
And what I won't do is let Donald Trump make me a liar.
Will you support a candidate?
I'll probably write in somebody. I haven't figured it out yet. Maybe Gary Johnson. Even though I'm not particularly impressed with Gary Johnson himself, I would like the Libertarian Party to have a little more sway culturally. And it would probably be, if this does go down to defeat, you know, if the Libertarian Party can hit some thresholds to get into debates the next time around, that would make me happy.
Tim Miller echoed those feelings about Gary Johnson.
I'll probably vote for Gary Johnson. You know, I wish that Gary was putting forth a campaign that felt credible. And, you know, I think that he seems to be about two steps off of that right now. And so I'm hopeful that he can put together a campaign that gives people a viable third option. I'll probably vote for him anyway. I would never vote for Donald Trump. I mean, he is by far the worst option in my view.
For Tim Miller, as with all of my guests, this November will be the first time since he turned voting age that he will cast a ballot for a presidential candidate who isn't his party's nominee. I asked him if this is a sad moment for him as a Republican.
Yeah, it makes me sick to my stomach. Yesterday or 2 days ago, I was in IRI, which is a group that does democracy promotion that was started under Reagan. And, you know, I walked in there and was just overcome with this just disgust, thinking about the fact that, like, this legacy of the Republican Party and the conservative movement of, you know, bringing freedom to people throughout the world, like, that we've passed this baton to Trump, who seems far more interested in supporting strongmen, you know, who criticize the Chinese dissidents fighting for their freedom and said that the people with the tanks need to be tougher. I mean, it's disgusting. And so, yeah, I guess the short answer to your question is I'm sick about it, to be honest.
Stuart Stevens summed it up best.
I am a sort of pathologically positive person, but I find what's happening depressing. You look at in the 30s, there's a reason America didn't, as so many Europeans did and around the globe, turned to an authoritarian strongman. And partly it was our citizenry and partly it was our leaders. And I think that Donald Trump is out of the political mainstream in this strongman tendency. And there's an ugliness about Donald Trump. I mean, I've been to a lot of Donald Trump rallies and they're almost always ugly. You know, Donald Trump speaks to that part that's inside all of us that feels, well, that one time you got cheated or you didn't get a fair shot or,
yeah,
you know, whatever it is that you know, kind of rubs you the wrong way. He tries to speak to that and play on it,
yeah,
much as George Wallace did.
Yeah.
And that's an ugly feeling. And that's why so many people come out of Trump rallies pumped up and sort of spoiling for a fight.
I called this episode The Holdouts, but that's perhaps a misleading title because it implies that we might at some point just suck it up, set aside our beliefs, and fall in line behind Donald Trump. That will never happen. I would no sooner put on one of those stupid red trucker hats today than I would have donned a brown shirt in 1938. And as much as Trump apologists want us to believe that his every reprehensible thought, word, and deed over the past year has all been some kind of carefully crafted Andy Kaufman-style put-on just to get him the nomination, no one on this show, including myself, is holding their breath for some magical day when Donald Trump is going to say, "Just kidding," and reveal himself to be a real conservative, much less a decent human being. Trump just isn't that good an actor. He's not even a very good liar. It should be apparent to all by now that Donald Trump simply is who he is. He's not going to change. He doesn't want to change. Instead, it's the Republican Party that's changing, remaking itself in his image, sacrificing long-held principles to accommodate Trump's continually shifting positions, dumbing down the party platform to accommodate his ignorance of and utter disdain for serious policy, including traditional conservative economic policy in the school of Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek, bait and switching it for the equivalent of a get-rich-quick seminar from a man whose recklessness has bankrupted four companies and ripped off countless hard-working Americans, replacing the GOP message with a never-ending string of clumsy, embarrassing apologies for his emotional insecurities and personal animosities, substituting blind demagoguery for love of country, and embracing, instead of denouncing, his rhetoric of hate, divisiveness, and retribution. I've been a Republican my whole life. Even before I could vote, I was a little Alex P. Keaton conservative campaigning as George H.W. Bush in my junior high mock election. But I, like many others this year, have come to the sad realization that the grand old party ain't so grand anymore. And if this is what's become of the party of Abraham Lincoln, then count me out. I want to thank my guests again, Stuart Stevens, Jonah Goldberg, Christy Todd Whitman, Tim Miller, and Kendall Unruh for coming on the program. You can follow Stuart Stevens on Twitter at Stuart P. Stevens, or at stuartstevens.com, Stuart spelled with a U, not an E. And order his new novel, The Innocents Have Nothing to Fear, on Amazon, or get the audiobook at audibletrial.com/kickasspolitics. You can read Jonah Goldberg's articles at nationalreview.com or catch him on Fox News. And his Twitter is @JonahNRO. Governor Christy Todd Whitman is also on Twitter. Her handle is @GovCTW. You can also keep up with her at ChristyWhitman.com and support her efforts to get a third party on the ballot at BetterForAmerica.com. Find Tim Miller on Twitter @TimODC, and you can support his groups at OurPrinciplesPAC.com and AmericaRisingPAC.org. And Kendall Unruh of the Free the Delegates movement is also on Twitter @ConscienceVoter. I'm not sure if her group will remain active after the convention, but you can check in on them at FreeTheDelegates.com. I thank all of my guests for taking the time during this busy convention week to come on the show, and I also want to thank all of you listeners who sent me flowers and cookie baskets and Amazon gift cards to console me during what has obviously been a disheartening week for me. Actually, nobody sent me anything. But in lieu of cookies or gift cards, you can brighten my day by making a donation to support the show at patreon.com/kickasspolitics. Please subscribe to Kickass Politics on iTunes and leave us a review while you're there. Follow us on Twitter @KAPolitics or visit Kickass Politics on Facebook.
And while you're there, recommend Kick-Ass Politics to your friends on your social media. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickasspolitics.com. But for now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass Politics. Kick-Ass Politics is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.